Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. 26 Answers to 26 Reasons is a live recording of a midweek class conducted by Pastor Lancaster in 2009 to answer common anti-missionary objections to the gospel. The class purchased and used Asher Norman's book, 26 Reasons Why Jews Don't Believe in Jesus, as a textbook for discussion. This book is available from Feldheim Publishers, copyright 2007. You can join the class by listening along as we defend Messianic Judaism and the claims of the New Testament. To support Beth Emmanuel in this important work, click on the support button at BethEmmanuel.org.
Reason number 16 of 26 reasons why Jews don't believe in Jesus. And reason number 16 amounts to more of a reason why Jews don't believe in Paul. Because reason number 16 is dedicated to the Apostle Paul. And I have to say that I found this frustrating, the work on Paul. And the reason I find it frustrating is because our author, Asher Norman, has relied heavily on the work of Chaim Maccabi. Chaim Maccabi, who wrote Paul the Mythmaker. You may or may not have heard of it, but it's liberal scholarship. It's perhaps, you know, some of the worst of liberal Pauline scholarship. Nobody takes it seriously. But Asher Norman, well, I guess I shouldn't say nobody takes it seriously, because the Jewish community takes it seriously and has readily accepted it. Asher Norman takes it seriously. In terms of legitimate Pauline scholars, nobody takes Chaim Maccabi's work any more seriously than gospel scholars take Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code. Do you understand the correlation? Okay, so, nevertheless, there is a family that used to attend Beth Emmanuel that lost their faith over Chaim Maccabi's book. So we don't, regardless of how trifling, you know, we have to take these things seriously. I'm going to read you his introduction to the chapter. The Apostle Paul arrived on the Christian scene around 50 Common Era, about 15 years after Jesus had been killed. Although Paul never met Jesus, he was the putative author, that is the purported author, of approximately half the epistles in the Christian Bible. In addition, Paul's disciple Luke was the putative author of the books of Luke and Acts, which describes how Paul came to dominate the early Christian movement. Luke portrayed Paul as a fearless, virtually infallible central character in the Christian story. Paul was described in Acts 15 and 21 as being in conflict with James, the brother of Jesus, and the head of the Christian movement after Jesus died, over the issue of the efficacy of the law. James supported the entire law. Paul strongly opposed the law. Paul was deeply troubled, wildly volatile personality. Significantly, Paul clearly revealed in his own epistles that he was often accused of being a liar. Well, Paul often uses that idiom, that turn of speech, to say, I am not lying. Yeah, I'm testifying the truth, I am not lying. So I think those are the citations he gives for that. The fact that the editors of the Christian Bible felt it necessary to reveal this embarrassing fact demonstrates that Paul's credibility was a major issue. In addition, Paul stated in his epistles that he believed that the ends justify the means. And we'll look at that as we go on. A strong case can be made that Paul lied about being born Jewish. This can be inferred from the fact that Paul used the word we when referring to Gentiles. There are significant indications that Paul was a failed convert to Judaism. You may be wondering, what are the significant indications? And the significant indications are a quotation from early church literature. I'll come back to it and we'll deal with it before we go on. Paul probably lied about being a member of the Pharisee party. This may be inferred from the fact that Paul worked as a policeman for the high priest, who was a leader of the rival Sadducee party. Paul probably lied about being a student of Gamaliel. This can be inferred from the fact that Gamaliel supported the law and opposed the high priest, while Paul opposed the law and worked for the high priest. Logically, it is much more likely that Paul was a Sadducee. since he worked for the high priest, who was the leader of the Sadducee party. Paul seemed to have distorted sexual nature, which was expressed through his theology. Judaism views sexuality in the context of marriage as holy, while Paul viewed sex within marriage as a concession to passion. An early Christian group called the Ebionites was comprised of descendants of the original disciples. The Catholic Church persecuted the Ebionites out of existence, but fragments of their writings survived. They wrote that Paul was a Gentile who became a Jewish proselyte, was circumcised as a convert, and studied Judaism. They said that Paul arrived in Jerusalem from Tarsus as an adult, hoping to marry the high priest's daughter. When she rejected him, Paul became enraged and wrote against circumcision, kosher laws, Sabbath, and finally opposed the efficacy of all the laws of Torah. All right, that's actually all true in that, that last bit there, that there is such a document. And I'll read it to you. This is from Panarion, Epiphanius. It's a 5th century church historian. He has his hands on texts that come from early Jewish believers, not too early in this case. Ebionites are, these are 3rd century documents, probably. Maybe 4th century documents. The Ebionites, we've talked about a little bit before. They are one sect of Jewish believers. And some of the things that characterize the Ebionites are their rejection of Paul. But not only a rejection of Paul, they reject the divine nature of Messiah. But not only that, they also reject the temple. They reject the sacrificial system. They believe that all of that was... God wanted all of that disposed of. So they're mixed up by the 4th century and 3rd century when these writings are coming to us, and they mostly come through Epiphanius and his quotations, and they come to us through the Pseudo-Clementine literature, which is a collection we have up here on the shelves. But by the time that we're reading their works, they are far and distant removed from the 1st century believers, hundreds of years later. But anyway, here's what they said regarding Paul, because they did have it out for Paul, no doubt. So Epiphanius, quoting from a work of theirs called The Ascension of James, no longer extant, says, "They assert that Paul was from the Greeks, the child of both a Greek mother and a Greek father, that he went to Jerusalem and remained there for a while, that he desired to marry a priest's daughter, that for this reason he became a proselyte, and was circumcised, and when he still did not receive such a girl, he became angry, and wrote against circumcision, and against the Sabbath, and against the law." Well, that explains a lot, don't you think? It always comes down to who didn't get the girl. Okay. How do you support that? They don't need to. If you were to read the Pseudo-Clementine literature, it's highly fictitious. It has all the credibility. I don't know any the rest of the church literature from the same period. I mean, the rest of the church pseudepigraphical gospels and apocryphal Acts of the Apostles and that sort of thing. There's just really no credibility there. It's several centuries later. Whereas the gospel, the epistles and the Acts that we have are primary sources that come from the same period of time. So, yeah, you can take this, or you could take this if you wanted. No one seriously would. Why would they write this about Paul, though? Why would they say this? Say you're a 4th century Jewish believer. Why would you say this about Paul? To discredit him. Yeah, but you're a believer, so why do you want to discredit him?
Church.
Exactly.
Building the foundation upon him.
To discredit the growing Gentile church, which has eclipsed the legitimate Jewish expression of faith in Messiah. And by legitimate, I mean that these people were Torah observant. They were still Torah keepers and so on and so forth. But they had lost control of the message, so to speak, and it had become this gargantuan movement of Gentile Christianity, almost completely predicated upon the teachings of the Apostle Paul. And so, in their arguments with Gentile Christians, the Ebionites used to argue several points And they are all around the Torah, and the Torah not being abolished and this sort of thing. But the Christian church would respond and say, you shouldn't be keeping the Torah because it is done away with. And how do we know it's done away with? Well, Paul says so. And so the Ebionites had every motivation in the world to perform a character assassination on the Apostle Paul, which they did. So, there you go. You learned something new tonight, huh? Epiphanius, if I'm not mistaken, is 5th century. So he'd be writing in the 400s about things that he has from the 300s. Okay? This is a great book, though. This is the tome. It's called Jewish Believers in Jesus. And so if there's a scrap of literary evidence from the early centuries, it's in here. All right, so that was, I read to you the introduction to the chapter. Now, this is a long chapter, and we're going to have to go pretty fast through this. Most of these arguments that he brought up in the beginning, he will return to. So we'll just move through it. I was so impressed and disturbed at the same time with that reconstruction, because it did take, it takes a lot of facts, little things that are true from here and here, citations from the epistles and, from here and from there, and then creatively recombines them into a completely new depiction of the Apostle Paul. We start out with a section called Paul the Policeman, where Asher Norman alleges that Paul was a policeman working for the high priest, Caiaphas. As a policeman for the high priest, Saul persecuted Christians even to their deaths. It is therefore very likely that Paul's actions were intended to protect Roman security interests, which implies that Christians were anti-Roman zealots. This is his quick conclusion. Let me explain the situation. In the Sanhedrin in those days, there was a Nasi, a head of the Sanhedrin, but then there was also the Kohen, and these two were placed opposite one another over the Sanhedrin. And the Kohen, the high priest, was placed there by Rome. And the Romans chose the high priest. The high priesthood is supposed to be for life. But instead, the high priest is put in by the Romans, and the highest bidder can buy the priesthood. So Caiaphas's family has bought the priesthood for Caiaphas. And so Caiaphas he sits on the Sanhedrin. We see him doing all the persecuting of the apostles and that sort of thing. But there's another guy who speaks up on behalf of the apostles, and that's Gamaliel. He's the true Nasi of the Sanhedrin. He's the Pharisee, all right? Whereas Caiaphas is a Sadducee. Paul is a disciple of Gamaliel. And so it's surprising to us to see Paul go to Caiaphas for letters getting permission to pursue the Jewish believers even outside of, these are letters of permission that he'll take to synagogues in Damascus and present and say, I'm from the high priest. So it's actually true that Paul does go to work for Caiaphas. But this doesn't mean that he was Caiaphas's policeman in the first place. Instead, here's what it means. Paul had a vendetta against the Jewish believers. He had zeal, he says. He calls it zeal. He had zeal to try to stomp this sect out. But his teacher, Gamaliel, had issued an edict regarding the Jewish believers saying, leave them alone. If it's from God, you won't be able to stop it. So Paul actually broke faith with his teacher and crossed party lines, kind of like a Republican voting for the health care plan at this point. He crosses party lines and goes to the Sadducee side. And he says, yeah, I'm a Pharisee, but we have something in common. I want to see these people silenced as well. And so he gets permission. And so that is the truth. That's truly what happens in the book of Acts. He never tells us what is the root of his zeal. He says, he cites it as an example of how zealous he is for God. He says in one of his epistles, he says, how zealous was I for God? A persecutor of the church. Yeah, it was a mitzvah for him. I think there's clues, though, as to what his issues were. Paul was a Greek speaker as well as Hebrew, but he would have hung out with, because of where he's from, Tarsus, he would have hung out probably at the synagogue of the freedmen in Jerusalem, which was a Greek-speaking synagogue. They probably did their liturgy in Greek. I don't know. I really don't know. But it was a Greek-speaking synagogue in Jerusalem. And Paul was probably the big character there because he sat in the rows of the Sanhedrin, one of the underlings under the head of the Sanhedrin. So he was probably a really big character in that synagogue. Then comes this guy, this twerp, named Stephen, and starts preaching. And you can kind of see Paul, it says in the book of Acts that Stephen refuted everyone who argued with him at the synagogue of the freedmen. And so you can kind of imagine the situation. Paul with the erudite education and Stephen coming, doing, you know, speaking this messianic stuff. And I suspect that Stephen just got under Paul's skin terribly to the point where he wanted to snuff out all believers. Because we're given that little clue at the stoning of Stephen. It says Paul was standing there, you know, with the coats. Yeah. All right. Yeah, well, Paul is zealous. He's zealous, zealous. He's zealous before he becomes a believer. He's zealous after he becomes a believer. He's absolutely has a heart for God, for sure. Even as he's persecuting the church, it's all for God, right? The master himself says to his disciples, there will come a time when those who put you to death will think they are doing God a service. I reject this notion that Paul was a policeman for Caiaphas. And that the further implication that Asher Norman draws, primarily from McCovey's book, the further implication is that Paul was working for Rome. So let me give you the sketch that we've got so far of Paul from the Asher Norman's drawing. First of all, not a Jew. A failed conversion, or perhaps not a failed conversion, but some issues going on there, right? And then working surreptitiously for the Roman government through Caiaphas, the high priest, as sort of what do you call those guys in the mafia that go around and break kneecaps? A goon. Paul has an epiphany on the road to Damascus. We all know about the experience that he has of hearing from the master and being struck blind. But Asher Norman is troubled by the fact that in all three places where this is related, Acts 9:7, Acts 22:9, and Acts 26:14, the details of the story are different, and the words that are reported from heaven are slightly different in each of these instances as well. So, he suggests that the account is therefore not reliable. All right, we don't even need to look these up. I mean, if we have more time, it'd be fun to look them up and learn them all. The problem with that, just from a textual perspective, the problem with that theory of saying, oh, look, there's discrepancies, therefore not reliable, is that they are all in the book of Acts. They're all written by the same hand, the same author. So, yes, if they were across different authors in different books, you could say, well, this is a discrepancy. But it's not a problem for a writer to relate certain details in one telling, other details in another telling. That's not an issue. But he does take issue with this one detail. So let's look this one up. Acts 26:14. Here's the voice. And we, it says, and when we had all fallen to the ground, I heard a voice saying to me in the Hebrew dialect, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? It is hard for you to kick against the goads. Have you ever thought, What does it mean to kick against the goads? G-O-A-D-S. Most of you... Yes?
A bucking bronco.
Okay.
A wild horse.
What is a goad? It's a prod of some sort. Yes, it's a livestock prod. And so in the Talmud, we'll see an ox goad is a unit of measure. You know, there's like, it was two ox goads long. You know, so it's a pretty standard idea, this, a goad. And the Talmud speaks about the words of the sages. Here I've got in, this is actually working off of a text in Ezekiel, where it says, the words of the sages, the words of the wise, are like goads, and like nails well planted, are the sayings of the masters of the assemblies, all given from one shepherd. You ever heard that before? It's in Ecclesiastes. It's a verse in Ecclesiastes. Okay, so the sages ask, why are the words of Torah likened to a goad? To teach you that just as this goad directs the cow along its furrows, you know, so it plows straight, in order to bring forth life into the world, so too the words of Torah direct their students from the paths of death to the paths of life. All right, so now all I've done here is demonstrate to you that goad talk is not foreign to Judaism, okay? In Judaism we know about goads. Why is this an issue for Asher Norman? He points out that this is actually a quotation from a play that I can't pronounce called, it's something like the Bacchae.
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 Yeah. It's the female followers of the god Bacchus.
Nice. Well, what do we know about these female followers of the god Bacchus? Have you ever heard of a rave? You know what a rave is? Back like 10 years ago, there were these raves that were really big.
How do you know about
that? That's my question.
I'm a teacher of Torah. It's my job to know these things. And there's a lot of drugs. Okay?
And they throw the bodies in the
air. And yes, and all sorts of debauchery and so that's what the Bacchae would be like. Because that is what the female followers of Bacchus, they would conduct these raves, basically, in the ancient world. So this is a famous play from 405 BCE. How long before the days of the Apostle Paul is that anyway? It's about 450 years earlier, okay? So about 450 years earlier, there's a famous line from this play. I guess it's famous. The god Dionysus says, that's the same thing, that's the same god, says, I would control my rage and sacrifice to the god, if I were you, he says to the main character, rather than kick against the goad. So you find that there is this Greek play that uses the exact same wording and to the same effect. That there's a god speaking to a human saying, quit resisting the will of the god. Why, you know, quit kicking against the goads. Therefore, Asher Norman says, it is therefore likely that Luke plagiarized Euripides' story. What would Luke profit by plagiarizing Euripides' story would be the first question. I don't know. But I thought, you know, I would look this up and just do a little bit of Google research and find out if it was possible to say, yes, this is a direct quotation from this play. And what I found was that if you go back about 100 years before Euripides, you find that it's already a saying. This is from Pindar's Odes. I don't know anything about it, except that it's 5th century. It says, one must not fight against a god who raises up some men's fortunes at one time, and at another gives great glory to others. But even this does not comfort the minds of the envious. They pull the line too tight and plant a painful wound in their own heart before they get what they are scheming for. It's best to take the yoke on one's neck and bear it lightly. Kicking against the goads makes the path treacherous. So, what's the point? Well, my point is that Perhaps Luke did not plagiarize Euripides. Perhaps he plagiarized Pindar's Oath. Or, from the play Agamemnon, bonds and the pangs of hunger are far the best detectors of the spirit when it comes to instructing the old. Do you have eyes that lack understanding? Do not kick against the goads, lest you strike to your own hurt. Okay, that's 450 BC. Or we can go the other direction, 4th century. Emperor Julian, Julian the Emperor says, he says, it is right to respect the country where I was born, since this is the divine law, and to obey all her commands and not oppose them. Or as the proverb says, kick against the goads. And here's one more. This is from the era of Hadrian, so before Christianity had really spread big. It's still very early. It's an alphabetical lexicon of poetical idioms, and one of them is, you are kicking against the goads. The saying is clear. So, what do we learn from this? We learn that it's in common parlance. It's a saying that was a common turn of phrase in the ancient world. So you can't say that he plagiarized it any more than we could, like, pick one. Pick anything. Pick anything that people say all the time. What did the proverb mean? Don't resist the will of God. That's what the proverb meant. And so our master uses this proverb. Surprising. But it's part of the time, part of the culture. You'll find this is a rule. If we are to disqualify something that's in the Bible on the basis that there's an earlier form of that in some shape or form, some earlier similar institution, saying, practice, whatever it is, in antiquity, in paganism, then we'll have to, we're just done. We're absolutely done. We would have to shut down the Bible. And I'm not talking about, if the New Testament's guilty of this, the Old Testament is way, way, way more guilty of this. That's the nature of it. That'll be important later on in this class. All right, we'll go on now. Paul's nature before and after. Ha! Okay, so Paul has this change. There's a before where he's Paul, no, Saul. Saul before and Paul after, right? And so what was Saul like before? Well, we would like to think of him, as he describes himself, a Pharisee, zealous for God, as regards the righteousness of the Torah, blameless. This is Paul's own self-description, right? But Asher Norman turns us to Titus 3:3 instead, where it says, "For we also were foolish ourselves, disobedient, deceived, enslaved to various lusts and pleasures, spending our life in malice and envy, hating one another." And so he says, now that's Paul describing what he was like before his conversion. Yeah. Okay, I don't need to say anything about that. How about after? Well, after, so we're going to go from that to Galatians. He's going to show us the Paul after. So we're trying to paint a portrait of Paul. You know, we're very carefully painting a portrait of Paul here. Asher Norman is, anyway. And he's going to take us to Galatians. Now, he quotes Titus 3:3 to show that Paul was just out of control. He was like an out-of-control sinner. Okay. And then he flips Galatians 2, 19, which says, in 20 actually, he says, "I've been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me." He says, look, Paul thinks that Jesus lives inside him. And then he takes us to 6:17, which says, "From now on, let no one cause me trouble, for I bear on my body the brand marks of Jesus." He says, Paul thinks that on his body he has the marks of Jesus. And so Asher Norman's point, his only point here is the guy is a loon. He goes from this kind of crazy, crazy, wild party guy to a guy who thinks he has someone living inside him. All right. So we're just building a building a profile as we work through here. A nut case. Next point. Paul did not learn gospel from Jesus or the disciples. And he takes us, of course, to the first chapter of Galatians where Paul says, I didn't learn the gospel. Right? And points out that, okay, Paul is this rogue guy who comes in here and he hasn't learned from Jesus and from the disciples. He never even met Jesus. And he made his own version of the gospel up. Which is it's very similar to what Paul says in the first chapter of Galatians, isn't it? That's essentially what he's saying there. Jesus' disciples didn't accept Paul. So we're building a case. What you're going to see happen is Asher Norman is trying to show us that Paul is on his own and completely separate from the Jewish believers in Jerusalem. And so he's building a case here, and it turns us to Acts 9:26, where it says, when he came to Jerusalem, he was trying to associate with the disciples, but they were all afraid of him, not believing he was a disciple. If you keep reading, the next verse says, but Barnabas took hold of him and brought him to the apostles and described to them how he had seen the Lord on the road, and that he had talked to him, and how at Damascus he had spoken boldly in the name of Jesus, and he was with them, moving about freely in Jerusalem, speaking boldly in the name of the Lord. But he left that part out. Anyway, we know that after that meeting, Paul actually spent 2 weeks living with Peter. He tells us that in the beginning of Galatians. But we're building a case. We're building this sort of Dan Brown Da Vinci Code version of Paul. He's a loony convert, not even Jewish. Nobody likes him. He works for Rome. He works for the Romans. He's a liar. He says he's a disciple of Gamaliel. He's actually a disciple, or he works for Caiaphas. And it gets more interesting. Paul did not have an appointment letter from James. Okay, this is very interesting. I think they might be right about this one. I think he might be right. Have you ever heard these? Let's go look at these passages, okay? This is really kind of historically accurate that you would get these letters of recommendation. In fact, it still would work that way in Judaism today. It's like credentials. You get a credentialing rabbi. I mean, if we were to take any of here, I'll show you an example, like a book. Okay, this is just kind of random. Here's a book that's put out by an Orthodox press, right? So if I turn to the first pages, I'm going to get, here, an approbation, a letter of approbation from, right there, from some recognized Orthodox authorities that can say, yes, the contents are kosher, contents of this book are kosher. So look at this now. 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 6. No, we'll start in verse 1. Are we beginning to commend ourselves again, or do we need some letters of commendation to you or from you? You are our letter written in our hearts, known and read by all men, being manifested that you are a letter of Christ, cared for by us, written not with ink, but with the Spirit of the living God, not on tablets of stone, but on tablets of human hearts. He's using that New Covenant language, and saying, see, that's our letter of approbation. Such confidence we have through Christ toward God. Now that we are adequate in ourselves to consider anything as, not that we are adequate in ourselves to consider anything as coming from ourselves, but our adequacy is from God, who also made us adequate as servants of the new covenant. Not of the letter, but of the Spirit. The letter kills, the Spirit gives life. And the letter that he's talking about here, he's playing with words here, but the letter he's talking about is an approbation, a letter of, you know, that this is. So, the background for this, according to the Ebionites, and you know, we've already learned you can't trust these people, they're out to make Paul look bad. But I think they might be right on this one. Here's from the Pseudo-Clementine Recognitions. We have, like I mentioned, we have this literature in the library here. Supposed letter from Peter, I believe, in this supposed letter. And he writes and he says, "Observe with great caution that you believe no teacher unless he brings the testimonial letter of James, the Lord's brother from Jerusalem, or whomever comes after him. Under no circumstances receive anyone or consider him a worthy or faithful teacher for preaching the word of Christ unless he has gone up there and been approved and, as I say, brings a testimonial letter from there." Do you remember a couple weeks ago in the Galatians series, a couple months ago, I don't know, when I was talking about how critical it was for Paul to go up to Jerusalem and get approval? That's what we're talking about there. That James and the apostles had the power to say, "You're done. You're not part of us." From what we read in Galatians, he got that. From what we read in Acts, he got that and more. From what we read in Acts 15, he got that and halakhic decision that approved his gospel. So yes. Yeah, that's exactly what he's talking about. But he's messing with words. He's playing with words there. Yeah, that's exactly what he's talking about there, the letter of the law. You are detecting something. I mean, Asher Norman's right about there is tension here. And I don't think you could possibly read the epistles of Paul and not pick up on the amount of tension there is in the apostolic community. And Paul makes it very clear what this tension is about. It's his gospel. His gospel is at variance with the majority opinion of the rest of the Jewish believers. And what is that majority opinion? That you need to convert. They weren't one law. In the sense of like, well, yeah, everybody should just keep the Torah. They were one law in the sense of everybody should be Jewish if they want to be saved. So, yeah, it's like the same thing, but a little different. Okay. Paul used signs and wonders and miracles. Why is that a problem? Well, because Paul did miracles and signs to imply divine sanction for his anti-law theology. The Torah imposes a death penalty on a worker of signs and wonders who attempts to turn Jews against the law. We've learned this. Okay. Right. So if we could find, that's absolutely true. That we've learned that, and we've learned it well in this class. So if we can find anywhere where Paul is actually telling Jews not to keep the Torah, that they don't have to keep the Torah, that they don't have to be circumcised, for example, then we'd have to say, yeah, Paul is a false teacher, and he's out. That would be really important. Paul verbally attacked the disciples and apostles. How so? Well, a couple examples. For example, over here in 2 Corinthians 11, verse 5, he says, "For I consider myself not in the least inferior to the most eminent apostles." Okay. That's not really verbally attacking. "But even if I am unskilled in speech, yet I am not so in knowledge. In fact, in every way, we have made this evident to you in all things." Yeah, it's maybe a little prideful. It's an honest moment, perhaps, that came through into the book of Corinthians. We find that there's a lot of those in Paul's writing, that it's all very real. It's very real male. It's a guy writing. When he's talking to the Corinthians specifically about other apostles, he's talking about other believers. And they are, we even have some indication of what's going on. There's arguments, there's several arguments. Different apostles have come through the Corinthian community. Paul started it. He's like, I was first. But then, since then, other apostles have come through the Corinthian community. And some have said, well, I follow Apollos. Some have said, I follow Peter's. Now, not that Peter was there, but Peter's opinion. You know, some have said, and so Paul says, you know, I'm glad I didn't baptize any of you. You know, I don't want to be anything but a follower of Messiah. And so he rebukes them for having schisms based on this following other apostles. And so the Corinthians start to do this sort of thing where they're like pitting one apostolic leader against another apostolic leader, using differences in opinion, which is a very normal sort of Jewish phenomenon, especially when it comes to Torah. Using those sort of differences in opinion and variations in practice as the grounds for arguing and splitting and forming other... You know, so by the time Paul is writing to the epistles to the Corinthians, they're no longer one congregation in the house of Titius Justus right next door to the synagogue of the Hebrews. There are many communities throughout Corinth and Achaia. Other examples of Paul being verbally abusive... Verse 13 of 2 Corinthians 11. He says, such men are false apostles, deceitful workers, disguising themselves as apostles of Christ. No wonder, for even Satan disguises himself as an angel of light. This is not the only time that Paul speaks. He comes out really strong against his opponents. I don't even know. I'm not up on 2 Corinthians 11 enough to even know what the issue is here. Verse 4, if one comes in and preaches another Jesus whom we have not preached, or you receive a different spirit which you have not received, or a different gospel which you have not accepted, you bear this beautifully. You put up with this very, very beautifully. I consider myself not in the least inferior, even though I'm unskilled. Did I commit a sin in humbling myself? I don't know. He's got issues with some other apostles. That's what's going on there. That's absolutely true. Yeah, it's a great chapter. This is the one where he gives all those little autobiographical sketches. Anyway, I don't know. I don't know the situation. I think Paul is pretty frustrated. There's these guys coming in, and they're pushing. They're selling themselves as apostles. Maybe they are, maybe they aren't. Maybe they're from Jerusalem, maybe they're not. Maybe they have letters, maybe they don't. But they're coming in, and they're certainly living off the community. They're sponging off the community. Because we see Paul criticizing them for that, and they're causing these upheavals. Okay, Paul taught a different Jesus and a different gospel. And so, there's a bunch of texts cited here. Asher Norman says, Paul began teaching his gospel of Jesus without having met Jesus, without learning with Jesus' disciples. Paul admitted in his epistles that he taught a different Jesus and a different gospel. How was Paul able to teach a gospel different from the disciples and the apostles? Yes, all true. He taught a different, well, not a different Jesus. He taught a different gospel. That's a really important thing to know about Paul and to understand about Paul. Paul's different gospel was this. The Gentile believers don't have to become Jewish. That's what was different. And that's what all of his problems with everybody else are all about. Paul had a theology that the end justifies the means. For example, in Philippians 1:18, when he says, some people are preaching the gospel from selfish motives or from envy or something like that. What do I care as long as the gospel is being preached, right? So he says, end justifies means. Or Romans chapter 3, I don't know what that says, Romans 3:7. If through my lie the truth of God abounded to his glory, why am I also still being judged a sinner? And why not say, as we are slanderously reported, as some claim that we say, let us do evil that good may come. Their condemnation is just. To which the explanation from Asher Norman is, in short, Paul was shamelessly willing to lie and tailor his gospel to his audience. It's out of context. Do you know the passage? If you back up a little bit. If our unrighteousness demonstrates the righteousness of God, what shall we say? The God who inflicts wrath is not unrighteous, is he? I'm speaking in human terms. May it never be. God forbid. That's not what we should say. For otherwise, how will God judge the world? But if through my lie, the truth of God abounded to his glory, why am I still also being judged as a sinner? He's saying, well, this is sarcasm. He's saying, if my lie shows how truthful God is, then why is he punishing me? You know, I'm doing something good for him. he's being sarcastic. But he gives us one more passage that's much more troubling, and that's 1 Corinthians 9. And I'll bet you've puzzled over this one yourself. 1 Corinthians 9, verse 19. It says, for though I am free from all men, I have made myself a slave to all so that I may win more. To the Jews, I became as a Jew. And here's his primary proof that he wasn't Jewish. Huh? See? He was a Gentile. How else could he become a Jew to the Jews? So that I might win Jews. To those who are under the law, as under the law, though myself not being myself under the law, so that I might win those who are under the law. To those who are without law, as without law, though not being without the law of God, under the law of Christ, so that I might win those who are without law. To the weak I became weak, that I might win the weak. I become all things to all men, so that I may by all means save some. So he says, the situation with Paul is that Paul was shamelessly willing to lie and tailor his gospel to his audience. And actually, this explanation here has been used by many Christian theologians and still is, to this day, used by many Christian commentaries and theologians to explain why sometimes Paul looks Torah observant and why, but how he can still speak against keeping the Torah. Because certainly if you just read his epistles on face value, there's no way that you can read his epistles at face value and come away and say, yeah, Paul was telling everybody to keep the Torah. There's no way. Does not compute, does not add up. I mean, I tried to do that for years and years and years. I finally snapped. You know? You can't twist it like that. So what you end up with is there's an essay in here about that, about the disjointed Paul. There's a long essay in here about how Paul, if you take an honest look at Paul, he's schizophrenic. Because he's like, the Torah's good, I'm keeping the Torah, I'm Torah observant. You don't have to keep the Torah. And it's like, you have two different Pauls, right? So what do you do with that? Well, here's what you do with it. To the Jews, I'm like a Jew. Under the law, I'm under the law. You know, go to synagogue, put on a kippah. Go to church, take it off. You know, it's like, so Paul's willing to dance whatever the music's playing. He's going to do the dance in order to sell the gospel, and that's how it's explained in Christianity. And that is disturbing. I find that really disturbing. There's some integrity problems. Yeah. Oh, I have no idea. I have no idea. I have no idea. I think his point here is different. First of all, I don't believe that Paul, as I'm sure you know, that I don't believe that Paul was wearing two hats, so to speak. I don't believe that Paul was teaching Jews not to keep the Torah at any point. I believe that his gospel was so radical that so as to say that Gentiles were not required to keep the 613 in the same manner, to the same obligation as Jews. And this is why he appears schizophrenic, is because even many scholars to this day have failed to recognize a basic core biblical distinction between Jewish people and Gentile people. And in fact, one law, the inverse of one law, is Christianity. That there is no... So you could read one law to mean all Jews and Christians should be Torah observant, or you could read it to mean all Jews and Christians should not be Torah observant. But when there's not distinction, it's the same for both. And so Christianity took Paul, not Torah observant, took the concept of no distinction, and voila, you got a new religion. I don't believe that. I have a more nuanced view of Paul now. So I would read this text like this. To the Jews, I became as a Jew, so that I might win Jews. He is a Jew. But to those who are under the law, what's the difference between a Jew and someone who's under the law? Exactly.
What'd you say?
To those who are under the law, to those who have become proselytes, as one under the law, though not myself under the law. How could he say he's not under the law? How could Paul say that he, as a Jew, is not under the law because he's not a proselyte? Yes. He hung out with them. He accepts them. It's not to say that he like switches his religion or something here.
Most of the Messianic Jews that I know do not see this in the context that he's talking about a proselyte.
Oh no, I understand. No, it's really a problem. It's really a problem because
it's a big problem.
Almost all of Messianic Jews also fail to understand the difference between Jews and Gentiles after coming to faith. And they all subscribe to the one law theory, and it's the no law theory. And so that's how we got into this situation. So he says, to those who are under the law, as under the law, though not being myself under the law, so that I might win those who are under the law, though myself not being a proselyte, so that I might win those who have already become proselytes. To those who are without law, who are they? Who are these? Gentiles, right. As without law, though not being without the law of God. You know, he hastens to add, but under the law of Christ. So he's not saying under the law in the sense of a proselyte, but I am under the law of Christ. Not that it's a different law, but he's not converted, so that I might win those who are without the law. The passage makes perfect sense to me now, whereas it never did before. Oh, how did Paul become like a Gentile? He says it in Galatians. He'll say it even in Galatians. He says, please, I beg of you, become like me as I became like you.
Yeah. This is one of the questions I've been seeing.
I think what it means, what Nanos suggests it means, is that, I think it's Nanos who says, I forget who I read who said this, is that Paul bends as much as he possibly can. He bends as much as he possibly can within the parameters of how he understands the Torah in order to, you know, meet wherever, on whatever level he can. And we see examples of this even in Orthodox Judaism today. People who do outreach, who do kiruv, bend as much as they can, you know, take the halakha as low as possible. How low can you go in order to meet the secular Jew and encourage the secular Jew? This is the example of the master. Why does he eat with sinners? Why does he hang out with tax collectors? You go as far as you... the question is, how far did Paul go? Well, we know a little bit about how far he went. We know that there was a dietary issue. That's what we see coming up in Galatians. There was a dietary issue. There's another opinion represented by the believers from Jerusalem that Jews and Gentiles should not have been eating from the same pot, so to speak. We know that that was an issue for him. And I suspect the dietary things were the biggest concerns. There's another opinion. This is Rabbi Lichtenstein's opinion, is that Paul would have gone even further, that Paul would have actually broken a mitzvah if necessary, in order to, you know, save a soul because of the greater good, which is basically what this guy's saying. But we don't know that, and Paul himself testifies otherwise. Paul himself would say, I didn't do anything against the Torah. Paul misrepresented Jewish theology. I didn't even put this down here because I think, I mean, I didn't even put the text down of Paul misrepresented Jewish theology. Certainly, the way that he pulls these texts out, yes, it's a misrepresentation of Jewish theology. I'll just hit you with a few of them from the book. Paul says the Torah is an impossible burden. Jewish Bible says...
No, it's not.
Right. Paul says it's an impossible burden. It quotes Hebrews. Yeah. Right. Paul lied and said the law failed to create righteous people, that nobody could be righteous through the works of the law, right? Hebrew Bible says, gives us a list of people that it calls righteous, you know, starting with Noah, you know, Noah and working all the way, you know, we've got many tzaddikim, many righteous people in the Tanakh. So, and there's quite a few of these. Paul replaced the law with grace. There's quite a few of these that you would have to say those are problems if they're not understood in the context that Paul meant them. If we understand them as blanket statements to cover all of humanity, some of them are problems, are problematic. Yes. Each one of them would require a class to discuss, okay, what did Paul really mean?
What about the marriage issue that you talked about in the introduction?
Marriage.
7.
Yeah. Well, what is, Paul says it's better for a man not to marry?
To be married, but because of...
So, yeah, that's what Paul says. Why does he say that? Why does he say it's better not to marry? You know, asceticism is not a dirty word. Asceticism is frowned upon in Judaism because there's a mitzvah to be fruitful and multiply. But there was an ascetic movement in Judaism of the first century. It was called the Essenes. They were very big. Yeah, so asceticism was around. It was part of, and it's not like from outer space. No, it's not a part of Judaism anymore. What's that?
Why is it implied by many that the thorn in his flesh is...
His wife. That is not. I've never heard that in my life. I have never heard that. That is a sick deal. Who says that?
Catholic Church, for one.
The Catholic Church doesn't say that. They wouldn't say that. They want Paul to be as single and pure as possible. So I would suggest to you that I think Paul says something about because of the current circumstances, because of the present time. I'd suggest to you that maybe part of the issue with Paul was just it's part of the Jewish tradition of the first century. The thing about Paul is he was probably married. You know, he probably had been married because, you know, that was just especially to be a Pharisee, to be under Gamaliel, to be that high in the government, so to speak, would be very unusual if he wasn't married. So his wife could have died. She could have left him when he became a believer. It says, Paul's gospel opposed God's laws. Paul's gospel opposed God's laws. And you get a whole smattering of different passages that would be used... I'm just looking at the list here, and I can see like Romans 10:4 blinking, you know, Christ is the end of the law, that sort of thing. So there's a whole bunch of these that are famous anti-Torah passages. So it says, from a Jewish theological perspective, each of these statements by Paul is heretical. Paul taught against God's laws, get this, to both the Jews who are obligated to the entire Torah, and to the Gentiles who are obligated to the 7 Noahide laws. So the way that Asher Norman is able to demonize Paul here on this point is by saying Paul made no distinction between Jews and Gentiles. He taught them both the same thing. Paul lied about his opposition to God's laws. So here's two passages where Asher Norman says, he takes Paul's statements where Paul says, I've never broken the Torah. I'm absolutely, you know, keeping the Torah. You know, I'm Torah observant. He takes Paul's statements like that And he even uses these to beat him up with and says, see, he's a liar. Some Jews, okay, so next point. James ordered Paul to stop opposing the Torah. James ordered Paul to stop. So what does this mean? This is Acts 21. He cites Acts 21 here. And so then he tells the story of Paul coming up to Jerusalem and James saying, people are lying about you and saying that you're teaching Jews not to keep the Torah, that you're teaching Jews not to circumcise their children. As far as Gentiles go, we already said this stuff, these four basic things. But here's what you need to do. You need to take a Nazarite vow, go get purified and that sort of thing, and prove to everyone that you yourself are walking orderly according to the Torah. And Paul does it. So that he cites that text. Here. Some Jews reacted violently to Paul's heretical teachings, and so we get some stories about Paul getting beaten up. Paul may have continued to work for the Romans while an apostle of Jesus. How do we know? So here's the real stuff, let me tell you. Back to Dan Brown. Romans 16, take a look at this. Romans 16, verse 7, this is his sending greetings to Rome, and he says, greet Andronicus and Junius, my kinsmen and my fellow prisoners, who are outstanding among the apostles, who were in Christ before me. So what? And then down in verse 10, greet Apollos, the approved in Christ, greet those who are of the household of Aristobulus. Now this, Aristobulus, this is Jewish royalty of the Herodian family. Aristobulus is a big name. And so this is like in with the Roman mucky mucks. And it gets worse. Listen to this, verse 11. Greet Herodian, my kinsman. So now, Paul just called some guy from the household of Herod, Herodian, some guy from the household of Herod, his kinsman. So what are the odds that Paul isn't actually working for the Romans? When he knows a guy named Aristobulus, and he calls a guy named Herodian his kinsman, and then we have more proof. You don't think that's enough proof that he was actually a Roman agent? How about this in Philippians? Chapter 2. Oh, dang. Where did I put Philippians? Galatians, Ephesians, there we go. That helped. Philippians chapter 2, verse 25. I thought it necessary to send you Epaphroditus, my brother and fellow worker and fellow soldier, who is also your messenger and minister to my need. And then, if you go down to the end of the epistle, chapter 4, verse 18, I received everything in full, have abundance, I am amply supplied, having received from, same guy, Epaphroditus, what you have sent. Secret stuff, obviously. A fragrant aroma, an acceptable sacrifice, well-pleasing to God. And my God will supply all your needs according to his riches in Christ Jesus. Now, to God, to our God and Father, be glory forever and ever. Amen. Greet every saint in Christ Jesus. The brethren who are all with me greet you. And all the saints greet you, especially those of Caesar's household. There you go. There you go. That's it right there. And of course, what else do we find? Acts 23:23. Paul has to get out of Jerusalem because they're going to assassinate him. What does the Roman governor there do? He assigns 470 troops to escort him down to Caesarea. Now, you're going to tell me that he's going to assign 470 troops to just some average Jewish guy for an escort down to Caesarea? And of course, here's the most damning piece of all, Romans chapter 13. What does Paul tell you to do? Submit to the government. Submit to the government. So you see, it all comes down to an anti-government conspiracy theory. These events imply that Paul continued to work for the Romans while acting as an apostle of Jesus. Significant bias in favor of Romans and against Jews. Paul was the true founder of Christianity, not Jesus. It was Paul that substituted faith in Jesus for God's law. It was Paul, or his disciples, that authored Christian theology. It was Paul that took this new religion to the Gentiles. Mm. It's really true about that Paul that brought this new religion to the Gentiles. And I think, you know, I've been frustrated with this because I felt like this wasn't a very good treatment. I mean, even as a criticism of Paul, it wasn't a very good treatment. But nevertheless, it should demonstrate to us this much, that if we've got Paul wrong, we've got everything wrong, because we're really built on this Pauline foundation. And in fact, we can look at misinterpreting Paul as the primary schism between Judaism and Christianity, actually more so than the identity of Jesus himself, is the misinterpretations of Paul. So Asher Norman finishes his chapter on reason number 16, Paul was the source of Christian opposition to Jewish law, which is true. That is a truth statement. That's an absolutely true statement. He finishes his chapter saying, I have no doubt that Jesus would pray in a synagogue, not a church. He says, if Jesus were to return, I have no doubt that Jesus would pray in a synagogue, not a church. I, too, have no doubt that Jesus would pray in a synagogue and not a church.